probably meeting with firefighters or something. Today we're going to be discussing capital bonding and the HEPA requests and others from, there we go, there's Senator Michelle is here, Senator Wigger is here. See just what I told you.
Just appear.
Yeah, they just appear when I start the meeting. So we're starting with, is it Orlin Miller, the Director of the Office of Capital Planning and Project Management from the University of Minnesota. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess you introduced me already, so I'm not sure that I need to do that for the record.
Yes, please do it.
Okay.
Do so.
I'm Orlin Miller with the University of Minnesota Office of Capital Planning and Project Management. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present the University of Minnesota's 2009 capital request to you today. And I will present the request, then Ms. Weller of the Bell Museum will elaborate on the Bell project, followed by Mr. Fitzenreiter, who will speak about the financing.
Okay.
Aspects. I want to start with the principles that are used to guide all of our capital planning activities at the university. These principles were adopted by the Board of Regents and focus on investing in strategic priorities, protecting our past investments primarily, but also taking advantage of opportunities for new facilities and addressing critical infrastructure needs. In addition, the principles include that the capital investments must protect the university's financial position and leverage private funding to the maximum possible. Before we talk about the HEPA request specifically, I want to remind the committee of the university's facility profile. The university has 800 buildings, actually over 800 buildings, and 28 million square feet throughout the state of Minnesota. It has some of the oldest buildings in the state. On the Twin Cities campus alone, 25% of all of our buildings are 70 years old or more. The university has some of the most complex buildings as well. As you know, the sophisticated research laboratories that we have, medical clinics, libraries, public assembly facilities. We have a facility of nearly every type imaginable, and that certainly does impact our care of existing facilities and our HEPA requests.
Mr. Miller, is there actually still a building that's 150 years old?
150, no. I believe the oldest is just before the turn of the century, so it would be about 110 or 12 years old, and that's Eddie Hall.
Eddie Hall. And what kind of programs are in Eddie Hall?
Eddie Hall is primarily student counseling at this time. I don't know that there's any active instruction going on there, but there's training and counseling going on in that building.
Thank you.
The replacement cost of all of our buildings system-wide is estimated to be in the area of $7 billion. So this is a major, major physical plant. To track the condition of these assets, we inspect on the Twin Cities campus 7 to 8 million square feet annually. This information about the condition of our facilities is captured in what we call the facilities condition assessment, an annually updated database for each building's condition, and we do run similar programs on all campuses. The idea is that over a period of 3 to 4 years, we cover all facilities, and then that just rolls over. So it keeps rolling over, so we have a ongoing update of what the condition truly
is. And how
is.
Many years does it take you to go through all facilities?
If you take the 8 million into 28, it's about four years
four
or
years.
So. 3 to 4 years. The information is, as I said, is captured in that facility condition assessment, and that's used as a tool to establish our priorities for capital repair projects, the HEPA request. So the university's 2009 capital request consists of two items, one that I've started to talk about already, the HEPA projects. The other is the Bell Museum of Natural History. And as you know, the HEPA is a category of state capital improvement funds intended for taking care of existing facilities. By statute, these funds are spent for projects of three broad categories: health and safety, building systems, and utility infrastructure. The health and safety includes our code improvements to existing buildings as well. On the Twin Cities campus, the HEPR request focuses on energy and utility infrastructure projects that support the use energy and utility principles and advance the university's sustainable goals, improving reliability and reducing operating costs. The chart on the, I believe it's slide six, indicates the allocation of a HEPR request by the type of improvement. I wanted to provide just a few examples of specific projects. We will provide to you the full list of HEPR projects, but it's a very long list, and I just wanted to hit on some of the highlights, indicate what we're doing on each of the campuses around the state. At UMD, University of Minnesota Duluth, we will be replacing failing and inefficient system for the campus pool, specifically climate control units that have deteriorated to the point of they're beyond repair. At Crookston campus, we need to make improvements to the university's technology and outreach center to comply with an MPCA and Polk County order. This relates to stormwater management and contamination of modifying storm sewers to avoid any contamination from animal runoff. At the University of Minnesota Morris, we will be replacing utility meters that are to be more effective in terms of metering our energy, and also completing tuck pointing and other exterior improvements to several buildings on campus. Improvements to lighting, insulation, and heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems on a number of buildings will be implemented at several of the ROCs, research and outreach centers. And as mentioned previously, on the Twin Cities campus, the focus will be on energy efficiency and utility infrastructure improvements, including steam pipe replacement, St. Paul Chilled Water Facility, which is replacing obsolete individual building chillers with a centralized system, and building recommissioning, which is basically a reconditioning or a tune-up of building mechanical systems to get more energy efficiency and operational benefits from those systems.
Mr. Miller, I think we would like the detailed list. In fact, I think I've seen it in my office. We may already have it, but it'd be useful to have for our members. It's actually very helpful for members to see that the university, to remind members that we have campuses all over the state and that they all have HEPR needs and HEPR projects that are being funded in this bill.
We will provide that. It's a very lengthy list, which is why we didn't include it in this presentation, but we certainly will provide
that. I didn't think
that.
It was that lengthy. I thought it was only like 3 or 4 pages.
Yeah. Lots of projects on the list. So. I'd like to move now to the second item in our request, is the Bell Museum in Natural History. You will recall that this project was approved by the House and Senate last year in the 2008 bonding bill and was vetoed by the governor. We're bringing it back. The Bell is more than a traditional museum. It is home for innovative programming and critical resources that provide material support for more than 50 university courses. So it's more than a museum, it's a teaching and research facility as well. It also increases the public's understanding of our natural history and supports the university's research and outreach missions. Has something over 130,000 visitors per year, including 20,000 teachers and students. There's always school buses out around the existing facility, and we're providing better accommodations for that in the future. The Bell Museum tackles issues of critical importance to the citizens of Minnesota, such as research on climate change, other issues of the environment, natural resource management, and energy and sustainability. Ms. Weller, the director of the Bell, will follow me and get into a bit more detail on that, so I believe I will leave the Bell Museum at basically the programmatic aspects of that at this point, and we'll go into the physical aspects of the project itself to provide a brief understanding of the scope of the project. It will be approximately 71,000 square foot building located on a 13-acre parcel, and that's at the southwest corner of Larpenteur and Cleveland Avenue in St. Paul. The building will contain exhibits, both permanent and changing over time, research spaces, classrooms, and assembly space. And it is proposed to be constructed in two phases. Phase one would include the museum building itself on the north site, north portion of the site, with parking and landscaping as part of that, and site grading and pond construction for the entire site. Phase two would include the landscape development and putting outdoor exhibits into the south portion of the site. This program is moving to more and more outside displays, exhibits, than has in the past, and they've been able to do in the past in their current site, and hence the reason for the larger site and the development of the south portion into to an area that will be devoted to exterior exhibits representing Minnesota's four biomes. That's coniferous forest, hardwood forest, oak savanna, and prairie. That's just a very brief overview of the project. We can provide additional information if you wish. But at this point, I think I will turn it over to Susan Weller to elaborate a bit on the Bell project request.
Okay, welcome. Is it Dr. Weller?
Yes.
Great.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dr. Susan Weller, Executive Director of the Bell Museum of Natural History. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I'd also like to acknowledge and thank Regent Simmons, Chair of the Board of Regents, for joining us this afternoon in support of the university's requests.
No, she's here so much I now forget to introduce her.
You recognize me. Vice President Miller pointed out, the Bell Museum's mission aligns closely with the university's. We were created in 1872 by the legislature and placed in stewardship of the university. We engage in research, teaching, and outreach. Our natural history collections of Minnesota's plants and animals continue to document our state's natural heritage. They're nationally recognized and used internationally by scholars. We also use these collections for educational purposes. We train the next generation of environmental scientists from kindergarten to postgraduate work. We estimate that the Bell reaches about 5% of the Twin Cities student campus population through our classrooms and museum programs. With the enhanced facilities on the St. Paul campus, we do expect that number to grow substantially. As Orlin mentioned, we do serve the K-12 community with over 20,000 students visiting us on site. Now, if the schools can't come to us, which with many budget cuts in the last year, we go to them. We serve over 5,000 students outstate from East Grand Forks, Detroit Lakes, Duluth, and south to Mankato. More than half of the Minnesota school districts have benefited from our educational videos, school curriculum, teacher training classes, and other educational programs. We've outlined the benefits of the new facility, but I would just like to briefly highlight the fact that this new facility will reconnect the public programming side of the Bell Museum with the fantastic environmental science research that occurs on the St. Paul campus, namely the Institute on the Environment, Raptor Center, Forestry, and other natural resource programs. Phase one will provide environmental teaching spaces, which are critical to our mission, and for phase two, we'll bring the learning that occurs indoors outdoors, and those surrounding acres south of the building will be designed as living outdoor classrooms. So it's, yes, it's an exhibit, but it's also a classroom, and it means that students and museum visitors of all ages will have enriched learning experiences due to this novel educational resource. Well, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I welcome any questions you may have about the project.
Senator Sharon, did you notice on the handout that the project's going to be built to LEED standards? It's very nice.
Senator Pappas, it's relationship to some language future in the bill
right.
here to try to be explicit about making certain that energy improvements are included in HEPA.
And Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I would add that the LEED standards also means that the that all the labor and materials come from within a 250-mile radius of the project, and it's estimated that of the 26 million we're requesting and bonding, about 24 will stay locally in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. The new facility, is it located entirely in St. Paul, or is part of it in Roseville or Falcon Heights, or Dr. Miller? Director Miller.
Yes. Madam Chair, I appreciate the promotion that
at least I didn't call you Senator.
Me, but I'm actually just a director. So, it is actually in Falcon Heights.
It's in Falcon Heights. Right. Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Does anyone on the committee know how to spell Larpenteur correctly?
L-A-R-P-E-N-T-E-U-R.
T-E-U-R. E-U-R. Okay, so you might want to correct that in future handouts. I knew it was wrong, but I couldn't remember the correct spelling. That's a little unusual.
I don't know.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Weller. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
And now, Mr. Fitzenreiter, is it Dr. Fitzenreiter? I've never asked you that before.
Madam Chair, I did a bachelor's degree in philosophy. I don't know why I ended up in money. Madam Chair, for the record, my name's Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer.
Senator Tomasoni?
Yeah, that explains a lot, Madam Chair.
It does. I just found out that recently, the philosophy thing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you turn to slide 9, what this slide depicts, and it's an assumption that, the bonding bill passes sometimes toward the end of session, but what this shows is the cash flow on the spending on the projects. These projects will all be encumbered and are ready to go, but we wanted to show you the spending pattern on the actual projects, and we expect to have 65% or roughly $49 million of the $74.5 million that the university is asking for in these two items actually expended, out the door, spent in the first year of the biennium. The bulk of the dollars will go in fiscal 10. And then the remaining roughly 35% or $25.6 million before the end of the biennium. So this shows you for HEPA and the Bell project the spending. And as you can see, the most immediate projects out the door will be the HEPA projects. The Bell project being new construction will have a ramp-up period and then a tail-off over the 2 years. That gives you a sense of how rapidly we anticipate being able to put these monies to work in the Minnesota economy. The next slide, 10, is just a status report on prior year HEPA spending. As you can see, for 05, we received $40 million. Fiscal 05, that's spent and encumbered. It's all gone. Nearly all the 06 money is, and almost 80% of the money received in 08 will be gone, and I'm very confident the rest will be spent this coming year. So with that, we'll just stand for any additional questions.
Well, according to Dr. Stinson, we're only going to begin to be coming out of whatever it is we're in, a recession, at the end of this year, the beginning of next year, so that continuing to spend that money on the Bell Museum, I think, will continue to provide jobs as we hopefully begin to recover.
As we hopefully do, Madam Chair.
Hopefully do, right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I haven't been a huge proponent of doing the Bell Museum during an economic downturn, but I think of it as more of a want than a need, but I am wondering if we couldn't ramp up more HEPA projects, because we have heard so many times about $100 million worth of needs, and, you know, how long would it take to ramp those up so that we would have another peak here shortly after the one that you're showing for HEPA?
Madam Chair.
Director Miller.
Senator Roebling. I think the detail of this we may need to refer to the Director of Facilities Management, but I can give you a general answer to that, in that we are putting another package together of a similar size that also tries to get those ready for rapid out the door. And most of those would be able to be achieved in this same time frame if the money were available.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then we'll move on to Sally Grants with Minscu.
Good afternoon. I'm Sally Grants, of course, from Minnesota State College and University System Planning Director for in Facilities.
Ms. Grant, I think you're going to have to speak up a little bit more. You might pull that mic a little closer, too.
Hello? Okay. Can you hear me now? Is this one on better?
They don't project very well.
Okay.
The mics, so you have to talk louder.
Okay. Sorry. First off, I want to thank you. We do have a couple of handouts here. One shows the two-page analysis of what we're asking for in 2008, and then also the colored one is our individual listing for the HEPR projects. I'm just going to walk through a presentation to sort of explain where we are at this point. First off, we want to thank you for the 2008 funds. You enacted $234 million, and we right now have spent 53% of that, or $123 million. We're forecasted within the next, by the end of this December, to expend the entire 99%. So we feel that rate is really good, and a lot of that is based on the fact that we do design in one biennium, construction in the next, so that when we get the money, we can hit the ground and go out with it immediately. So for our 2009 projects, this is obviously the big word is shovel ready, and that's what we're trying to do to get more people to work. We're proposing three basic factors. The first is the HEPR list at $50 million, and then we have the vetoed projects that were approved by both legislative branches, and then we have four projects that were partially funded in 2008. We believe to total this $117 million will get 1,500 construction and related jobs moving into the economy. So for HEPRA, as was noted before in the previous testimony, this is for major building repairs and renewal. This particular HEPRA project, though, was more specific in that we really strove to get it directly into labor market areas to get people working along with energy efficiency. So, for instance, we didn't go for really large boiler plants that had like 80% of materials and only 20% of labor. We do have two or three boiler plants that are listed in here, but they actually are reversed where it's like 80% labor and only 20% material. And the idea was to get them moving as quickly as possible. This is to go directly into our $110 million per biennium request that we've done in a plan that Al Johnson has presented to you in the past that reduces our backlog by 50% in the next 10 years. Our current backlog is $685 million. And again, similar to the University of Minnesota, we do a facilities condition assessment, a little bit different than them, but we do an analysis on all our 26.1 million square feet. So the HEPR allocation, as I noted, is driven by the college and university priorities, warm, safe, and dry, all the technical components of the statute. But as noted, this particular year we are looking at fast execution. We really did a good dialogue with the campuses to figure out what that fast execution was. And we do believe that we can get $40 million under contract by December 29th if we get the money in June. We believe that we can get 80% of that $40 million working for the economy. And then as noted on slide 6, you can see how that is distributed. We have, if you add together the critical pieces of exterior renewal, HVAC, and roof replacement, which are our energy efficient components, it adds up to almost 63% of our proposed request on this. So that was a really important piece for us. So the other component of this is our vetoed projects. There are five projects there. They are listed, again, on this sheet right here and also on slide 7. and 8. Those are North Hennepin Community College. That was the business and technology renovation and addition, the 7 small classroom renovations at 7 campuses, and Lake Superior Health Science Addition, Metro State University Classroom Addition, and the Mesabi Range Shop Space Addition and Renovation that was moving from leased space onto the campus. All of these projects will be able to be bid within 30 days, and that's a really important component of this, is that they're ready to go. The only exception of that is the classroom renovations, and that's because we haven't done advanced design on these. These are small, anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000 little classroom renovations. But we do believe we can get those out in 120 days. So that's an important component. The other project that we added to the list, because we were looking for economic stimulus pieces, that was the 4 projects that were already given design funding in 2008. Those projects are Hennepin Technical College, both at Brooklyn Park and at Eden Prairie. That $10.6 million is split between the two of them. It's a library resource center renovation. And Minnesota West, Worthington, a renovation and addition at Fieldhouse there. Southwest State at Marshall had a science lab renovation. And then St. Cloud Technical College, the Allied Health renovation. So those total $26 million, and they can all be bid within 120 days of getting this. And we included a larger sheet that shows the color document that gives a better explanation of exactly how those monies will be hit. You can see by the yellow bar indicates the bidding line, and that means that once that is done, there are contractors that have contracts, and they're ready to start buying material and hiring people to get them going. So that's where we are in terms of our budget. Our 2009 request is $117 million. We really believe that we can get $83 million working under contract by the end of this year. From our discussions with contractors and others in the building industry field, we feel that's 1,500 construction-related jobs that will be working on this.
And members can see these are from this list, which I think is very helpful, is from all over the state.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have 46 communities, 54 campuses, and each and every institution will be impacted. We also have before you in 2009 some statute changes. The first is, and this is listed on slides 14 and 15, is the increase to the revenue fund. What I previously discussed to you was the general obligation bond funding. We also are allowed to sell bonds for our residential and student unions. In the past, this has only been open to the 4-year universities, and last year the legislature, upon request from our both students and well as leadership, we opened it up to the 2-year campuses. And the current debt right now is $155 million. Our capacity is up to $350 million for this. But there are 4 new projects, 3 of which are 2-year colleges that wish to come forth with projects. We're allowed $200 million, and with bonding rates, we really need to be above that, and so we're asking for the approval to get that up to $225. These are financed through user fees at each one of the institutions. It's not an overall. Each institution is responsible for its own debt for that particular project, and there has been student consultation and approval at each one of these campuses. The statute is below on slide 15. The other statute change is to allow Southeast Technical Winona to sell its aviation center. The hangar facility has not been in use, has an aviation center for the last 3 years. Currently they have the machine tool die program, drafting and carpentry program there. They would like to right-size their campus, downsize their campus, and bring those programs back to the main campus. And in order to do that, the City Port Authority would like to buy the facility, and we'd like to take the money from that sale, pay off the remaining $500,000 GO bonds on that and then use it to renovate and do a small addition at the main campus.
Members, Ms. Grants is explaining these to us but for our information, but they're actually, we're not going to actually have the bills before us. The bills will be in capital investment. It won't be in our bill.
Senator Pappas, are these bills already formed and introduced, or are these yet to come?
They're either introduced as bills or they will be included in Senator Lanx's draft or amended to his draft. But I don't think that there's been any objection so far. If you have objections, we should know about it. We should hear about it.
It would be Senator Langseth that would have a bill related to the statute change for
yes, that would be included
funding?
In the bonding bill. Right. Now, what we just passed out was the University of Minnesota HEPA request plan, which is 2 pages. So I'm not sure why they couldn't have brought this, but we had it downstairs. Okay, proceed.
The next are three language changes, both for Metro State University to allow them to use internal and non-state money for the law enforcement program that's going to be built at the Hennepin Technical Center, Hennepin Technical College Brooklyn Park campus. Also to allow remaining use of funds that were already authorized from to obtain Owatonna Center. And the third piece is to allow use of funds that were given from the Brown Hall project that came in under bid to use those funds for the new science and engineering lab building. And all those three are listed in slides number 19, 20, and 21. And I can answer any questions on those if you have any.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Can we just go back to slide 17 for a minute? And I see this is proposed language. And I don't know how often this happens, that if the sale of something that was paid for with bonding money usually comes back, but this is saying that it would stay at that campus. And, I mean, I guess it's kind of up to the Minsky system to determine that. If normally, I would think it would come back and take the next highest priority on the Minsky list and not necessarily stay at a campus where we do or do not know if that's one of the top priorities for the whole system.
Well, currently,
Grants.
Currently, the programs that we have there, we can't move them back to the main campus unless we have some funds for doing right-sizing and correct renovation of that. So that is part of the consideration there, is that we have a large facility there that we don't need the entire facility at a remote location. And if we move them back to the main campus, it would be a benefit both to the city, Port Authority, as well as to our campus, because we would be downsizing the size that we were needed there.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Vice Chancellor King.
Senator Roebling, also to your question, it has been this body's practice that on occasion like this, when we request authority to recycle sale proceeds, that we recycle them at the campus. We did it in Hibbing when we sold one of the Hibbing properties, and we did it one other place. It's part of our expectation that presidents exercise stewardship with their assets, and one of the ways you incent that behavior is to provide for them the ability to program the money for another higher use at the campus. And so that's just the way we've approached it over the years. In this instance, I just also would observe that this was an asset purchased, I believe, before the merger.
It was by the
school district.
By the school district.
So there's no GO, I won't say taint, there's no GO history on this acquisition.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Members, I guess it hasn't been the custom, I'm not sure why, for the Higher Ed Committee to officially review bonding changes such as these that relate to higher ed, other than informally by staff, and usually they tell me about it. But if you would like us to do that, you know, Senator Langseth has a very informal process, and we certainly could let them know next year when we have a big bonding bill that if there are any higher ed changes, that they should be reviewed by our committee in a more formal way. I mean, there's no reason why we couldn't introduce bills, and we couldn't. I mean, I guess I do think this letter system is a little strange that we do. we have a letter coming up. But we could certainly do that. We're all in the finance committee, and so we just pass bills over to another financing division. It doesn't have to go to the floor or anything. So, which is, I see heads nodding. The other thing I noticed that there are some pension changes that are coming up that Minsky's requesting, and I've decided that our committee should review those before they go to the pension committee. And that's just us trying to provide a little bit more of what our job is. Okay. Anything more on these bonding provisions or the keeper list or any other questions? Ms. King.
Madam Chair, if I might just to back up a little bit to the question of increasing the capacity for the revenue fund.
Yes.
Just to share with you that there has been some discussion about that request, really around the issue of total debt load, both at the system level and in the case of these programs, of course, all this debt is supported by fees paid by the students. And so we have had some questions about that, and we're prepared to answer any questions folks have. We're doing some more work on it for some other folks that have asked some questions. We do require and have received from the student associations at the related campuses strong endorsing letters, both for the projects and for the fees that will result from the projects. But I wanted to share with you that there has been a little bit of a discussion about that request.
Okay. And this was increased last year, right?
Madam Chair, it's been increased several times. I believe we were before you a couple of years ago looking for a larger increase. You asked at that time that we come back and do it in increments. And so that's the approach we've taken. So you'll see it again next year, most likely.
And you means the legislature, not necessarily me, personally. Any other questions? Okay, then we're going to, I guess we're going to hear Senator Sharon's bill. This time we are going to hear an official bill, Senate File 621. Oh, I wanted to say before Ms. Granz leaves, and this is very appropriate for you, Senator Sharon, please sit down, is that she is the driving force behind energy efficiency and green construction at Minsky. So when I told her about your bill, she was very excited.
You want to testify on it?
Come sit
not
next to her.
Not by means. Speak in favor
that's
of
all
it.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Pappas and members of Higher Education Committee. This is a bill that came to me from Representative Wagenius in the House. And Senate File 621 is in front of you. What it does, well, let me just give you a little background. In listening to the presentation from the university and from Minsky about HEPRA and about those projects, the questions were raised there about whether or not the language was explicit enough to make certain that HEPRA requests would include energy efficiency improvements. And because the testifiers were not able to say with certainty, there was some assumption, some belief, and expectation that that's what they would do, it was decided in the House that maybe that language should be added so that we would explicitly include our interest in that as a part of this language. So what you see is adding language to this statute that adds language that refers to the capital budget expenditures for higher education asset preservation replacement, and then adds language building energy efficiency improvements using current best practices. And that's the simple background and essence of the language. It's to be explicit about that.
So, members, just procedurally, why couldn't we? Why? What's wrong with that? Oh, okay. Okay, let's ask about that. Well, so we have this bill, and kind of a normal process would be where we would vote on whether we wanted to approve this and forward it to the Capital Investment Committee, right? It even says related to capital investment, but then it says higher education. Instead, we're going to include it on, I think you've passed out this letter to everyone, right? Oh, not yet. There's a letter coming that will indicate our support, and we can always change that if people don't want to support it, but I pre-prepared the letter. So it is kind of interesting that You know, why can't we just transfer bills over to capital investment? Why are we just transferring letters? Do you want, yeah, Senator Sharon, you want to move your bill? Mr. Fuller did have a question about using current best practices. How do you define current? And maybe you want to be a little bit more forward-looking. So maybe just even taking that out, just saying best practices. Why do you use the word current?
I think that I asked the same question. How are you? Is there a definition anywhere that says what is current best practices? What the interest is here, and maybe it can be achieved by removing the term current, it is to make certain that it is not using an old energy efficiency process, that we are bringing it to the most recent, most innovative, most current kinds
then
of practices.
That wouldn't be considered best practices if it was an older system. So Ms. Grand, did you want to comment on that, Grands? What do you think?
Chair, first off, I just have to say that we do consider energy efficiency, and it is interesting because over in the House we discussed it and after the fact with Representative Wagenius. And we do, whether it's explicitly or implicitly, I guess I just want to assure you that, you know, as stewards of institutions, you know, the University of Minnesota talks about 150 years. We've got 100 years. Our goal is to make sure that this is done. In fact, our design standards, which we have, that we do design and construction to, is actually probably, if it was certifiable, it would be at a silver level of LEED. I mean, that's how we build. I do share some concerns about the word current best practices. As we like to say sometimes anecdotally, we want to do cutting edge but not bleeding cutting edge, because we want to make sure that it's been a proven cutting edge piece so that we're not the guinea pigs with taxpayer dollars on energy efficient kinds of things. So I think we share some concerns, but we're more than open to whatever you layer on to us. I think that the issue here is that energy efficiency is critical. We all realize it, and anything you can do to codify and statute, I think, helps it. But there is some concerns about the phrase using current best practices.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon. This is perhaps a question from a new member of the committee related to the standards, but has there been any conversation at all about including water efficiency or water conservation along with, as we're starting to talk about energy efficiencies, we really need to be dealing with water issues as well. And I know there's lots of emerging technologies in terms of low flow appliances and water cutoff valves and all sorts of things. So has water been part of the discussion?
Ms. Grants, would water efficiency be under the definition of energy efficiency?
Chair Pappas, Senator Erickson-Robes, in my estimation, it would not be. However, I reiterate that when we do replacements of any kind of infrastructure or repair, we do use low flow water heads and we do other kinds of things. I don't think that on our HEPA-related project we would go to something like a gray water system.
It's not legal. I don't, Madam Chair, I don't think it's legal right now, although we could argue whether it needs to be.
So I would say that no, it would not be included here. But again, it would tie back to, you know, we have the B3 guidelines that are in statute for all major renovations. So this would it's sort of eeks over into that area there.
So, Senator Roebling.
Oh, I'm not on the water issue. I don't know if you're done.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
It just seems to me, Madam Chair, that maybe it's something we could consider. I don't know if this is the proper venue for that topic, but I think it's something we really should at some point get into statute, because there are people that literally read every single word and says, well, if water efficiency, water conservation is not on the list, then we don't do it.
What did you say, the B2 guidelines? What are those?
B3. Senator Pappas, the B3 guidelines that require us to build sustainable into in all aspects mm-hmm. of our building for both new construction and renovation in all our capital bonding projects. Mm-hmm. I don't know the statute offhand, but that's
so we already have some sustainability statutes. Okay. So maybe we should take a look at those and see if they need updating or changing or mm-hmm. whatever.
Thank you.
That's where they're located. Mm-hmm. Say, what is that, 16B?
Mm-hmm.
16B .325, he thinks. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, speaking for myself, I just wonder if we really need to do all this stuff. I would think that the people at the university or Minsky or I'm assuming are very smart people, and I think that they'd want to know that this is the direction that we should be moving. So I guess it makes everybody feel good, but I just wonder if we need just more and more words in the statute. I, for one, don't think so. I think that at least I can speak for my constituents. Every time the legislature goes in session, they get very worried. And I just, for one, think we've got enough laws on the books. So anyway, just thought I'd weigh in on that.
And Senator Coring, I think it would be a very good effort to go through the statutes and take out unnecessary words and language
idea.
And legislation. And, you know, I've tried to do that myself in the past. I know others who have, and you'd be surprised how controversial it gets. Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think that the using best practices kind of satisfies my concern, but one of the things that I worry about is that we require energy efficiencies that will never pay for themselves. And so I think if they're best practices that they probably have to. But I'm not sure if that would be the description sort of what a best practice is. But I want to make sure that, you know, you can spend a lot of money to cut down certain greenhouse gases, but you won't save a lot of money. But you might cut down gases, but you won't save any money. And so I'm thinking that right now I'm looking at the cost efficiencies and not just the gas efficiencies. And I'm concerned. I want both, but if I can't get the cost efficiencies, I don't want the other one at a great cost.
Senator Pappas,
Sharon.
I think that it might be interesting to hear some more information about this, but best practices would, as a part of it, have a 10-year payback.
At the most.
I would argue that I think there is a value, a larger value, besides just straight off the top cost savings, that there's other obligations that we have around greenhouse gas emissions. But I think that if you could speak to the payback on these efficiencies, on these best practices.
Ms. Grants.
Senator Pappas, Chair Pappas, we strive to do even 2-, 3-, and 4-year paybacks on a number of things, which we're able to do because many of our buildings were built in the 60s and were very energy inefficient. But anytime we usually on a regular basis on any major project do a return on investment to figure out what is the best way of looking at whether it's a steam system or water or with different kinds of boilers. We look at that and do an evaluation, and we do a return on investment on that on a regular basis. So, again, you wouldn't put that in here, but that's a practice in which we evaluate our major projects with.
Thank you.
So we do have, Mr. Fuller was right, we do have sustainable building guidelines. And for the Department of Administration, the Department of Commerce, shall develop the guidelines, right?
It's geobonds.
When you're using geobonds, mm-hmm. right. So do you want to look at these, Claire? Okay. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
So do we need this then?
I don't know. Some people may think we still need it. Senator Sharon thinks
well,
we
there was enough question about whether or not it was explicit enough to allow to make certain that HEPRA included building energy efficient improvements, that this is being put forward for the assurance of the explicitness in the language.
Renovations too. Okay.
Substantial renovations.
substantial. So we think the statute applies to substantial renovations, so we're not sure if HEPRA, some HEPRA projects would qualify. So it's worth doing. And so do we want to take out the word current, though?
Yes, I would accept that as an amendment or offer as
an
amendment.
Okay. Yes. Senator Sharon moves on line 112 to delete the word current. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any other questions? Then,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Tomasoni?
Do we need best practices in there?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Good. Yeah, we do. We need best practices. Then Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 621 as amended be recommended to the Capital Investment Committee. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, aye. Nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then let's pass out the memo. Oh, we did? Okay. Are we going to pass out these bills, too? Somebody better describe them. I don't know what's in it. Okay, we have a little bit of a glitz here. Let's do this at the end of the meeting so I can at least. Members, in the letter, you see listed three bills. One we have before us. One is Senate File 781, and another one is 990. So it includes HEPRA, at a rate that Senator Langs has set already, and it includes the vetoed projects in the Bell Museum a bill by me. So the question is, we don't have these bills officially before us. Do people want to see the bills before we vote on this letter? Senator Roebling is saying yes.
Yes, I
will. Okay, we'll get the bills, copies of the bills for everyone, and then we'll take this up at the end of the meeting.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni?
I think we discussed the bills already, though.
We have. I mean, we've discussed it, and since we discussed the HEPRA, we discussed the vetoed project, we discussed the Bell Museum.
So the bills would be just a repeat of what we've already talked about and what we already have in front of us here.
Well, we have it in concept in front of us. We don't have the actual bill and the actual language.
But it would be a repeat of what we just talked about.
Yes, there'd be nothing new in there, I don't believe. It could be I don't know what level the HEPRA is. I don't remember.
See, that's what I would like to know.
You'd like to see what level. I think that's the level we're recommending it at, whatever it's in the bill. I can't remember what it is. It's probably what they requested, but I'm not sure. It is?
Yeah.
Do you want to just look that up? 781. Okay. Well, that's okay. Well, you can just put this aside, and let's just get at least one copy for Senator Roebling. We can pass it around.
Okay.
Okay. 781 and 990. Okay. Okay, then we do have another thing. We'll come back to that at the end of the meeting, and let's invite Dr. King back up. Are you a doctor or a vice chancellor? Vice chancellor?
Madam Chair, I keep waiting for someone to
give you an honorary doctorate.
So that someone can give me an honorary.
Honorary.
And I haven't done that yet.
And this is Director Kudrowski?
This is Karen Kudrowski.
Karen Kudrowski, welcome. We are. This is a continuation of our overview discussion, what we ran out of time to do in our last meeting.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Senator Coring, yeah.
Madam Chair and Ms. Kudrowski, are any relation of the Kudrowskis up in the Little Falls area at all?
Madam Chair,
Kudrowski.
Yes.
Really? Clara
She's for marriage.
Clara, Madam Chair and Senator Kudrowski, Clara Kudrowski is the lady that actually is the person that got me elected. So I know that's.
So you're going to go easy on her.
Yes, very easy.
Thank you.
We won't hold it against you either.
Yeah.
She wasn't sure which way to go with that question. Madam Chair, we're just going to jump in where we left off. That's acceptable.
Yes.
I'll turn to Karen.
Where was that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. What I'm going to do is address the non-resident tuition funding, the master green sheet. I'll go through the allocation framework briefly and then touch on reserves.
Okay, are we looking at a page or anything anywhere?
Yes, I will in a minute.
Okay, great, thanks.
And then I'm going to have Vice Chancellor King will talk about the financial statements, and then I'll finish up with the tuition study.
Okay.
So you've been handed a couple documents. One is a series of handouts. It's an oversight review on the cover page. Those are handouts that we'll refer to during our presentation. And then you also have the document. It's kind of the whole testimony from what you heard at the last hearing, some of the follow-up questions, and what we're going to be presenting today.
Great.
And I'm just going to work down the questions that you had asked for us to testify to. On the non-resident tuition funding, you had asked to review the extent of institutional response to the legislative decision to fund specific campuses. Colleges and universities that had eliminated the non-resident tuition rates prior to the legislative action felt they should have received appropriation to cover that lost revenue. Prior to the legislation, there were 3 universities and 8 colleges that had made the decision to move to a single rate. Mm-hmm. Those who currently have a non-resident tuition rate wonder why they were not on the list to receive funding.
If you go to the handout.
In the handout on page 1, you'll see the non-resident institutions that were eliminated the non-resident tuition rates. And it's on page 1. And in column A, those are the colleges that were funded in the 2007 session. And then the next column was those institutions that also eliminated the tuition, the non-resident, and they weren't funded as part of the 7th session. But 4 of them we picked up in the 2008, from the language that we received from the committee. There's still a number of institutions that have a non-resident tuition rate, which you can see in column C. So that gives you an idea of who has eliminated and who still has a non-resident tuition rate. There was also an issue that arose with respect to the Wisconsin reciprocity students.
Wait a minute. I'm trying to understand this. Slow down a little bit. The
first
colleges the colleges that had gone to non-resident tuition years ago on their own, what are those colleges?
Those would be, we don't have a column specifically identifying,
okay.
But an institution, for example, Central Lakes, already had moved to one single rate, and it could have been 3, 4, 5 years ago.
So they're kind of blank.
Correct.
Right. Okay, I understand. So it's Central Lake, and then if we go down,
we have Minnesota State Community
Minnesota
and Technical.
West,
mm-hmm.
Northeast Higher Ed. No,
they still have a non-resident rate.
They still
and
have
then
non-resident.
Northland, mm-hmm.
Northwest Technical College of Bemidji, Ridgewater, Riverland, South Central, but none of the 4-year colleges have a non-resident.
Madam Chair, for the 4-year institutions, Bemidji has eliminated
and
the
Moorhead,
non-resident. Moorhead.
And Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So there's still 4 of the universities that have a non-resident tuition rate. In regard to the Wisconsin reciprocity issue, that
issue.
Are
there any questions on the flat tuition before you go on? I just want to make sure. It's my understanding that the colleges that are doing non-resident tuition will continue to do that into the future. We haven't heard from any college, and that's what Ms. King told me earlier, that they're planning to revert back. Even if the legislative mandate went away, they would still continue with their non-resident tuition.
Madam Chair, they would still continue without an out-of-state rate. Yes, column. We expect
yes.
Column C, A and column B
to continue
to represent colleges that do not have a separate rate for out-of-state students.
Right.
Yeah. We have not had any indication that presidents are considering reversing that decision.
Or the ones that have been doing it for a while that were
or
not
given
funding.
Or the ones that
funding.
Are over in the
are,
first column, right.
Yep, that are blank.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Okay, great. Now move on.
I'll move on to the Wisconsin reciprocity issue. And this was one that affected the community and consolidated colleges, not the universities or the technical colleges.
Do you have a page on this?
32.
It's within this discussion? Okay. Okay.
And the Wisconsin Reciprocity Agreement does not include the technical colleges, and Wisconsin had brought to our attention that to accomplish the purposes of the Reciprocity Agreement by granting students access to public post-secondary education in the neighboring state at a rate below that charged to other non-residents, the colleges that had moved to a single tuition rate had to charge that rate to the Wisconsin students, rather than what had been the practice of charging the higher Wisconsin reciprocity rate. This caused a significant loss of revenue at the community and technical colleges that had the single rate. And Century College was the institution with the greatest loss of revenue. And it was about $150,000.
And that's the same? Nothing's changed with that? Nothing else is resolved?
Correct.
Okay. Is there any effort on the part of MNSCU to do any, or to tell the Office of Higher Education to do any kind of renegotiation over that? No. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
You know, it's interesting because my son was at South Dakota State, and they went to, I believe, a non-resident rate. But because we had an agreement with them, the Minnesota kids were paying more than anybody else from any other state.
That's, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that's exactly the fact set that got Wisconsin so excited. Because they found that Wisconsin students in Minnesota at schools that didn't have an out-of-state rate were paying more than the Minnesota students. And that seemed to violate to them the spirit of the agreement. And we were unable to argue otherwise. So they are now paying the Minnesota rate as a Wisconsin student.
Well, Madam Chair, we should argue that with South Dakota then, too, because our students are paying more than all the other students attending there.
The agreement with South Dakota must not contain the same language.
Well, traditionally, students who go to school in Minnesota, 70, 80% of them stay in Minnesota. But that's only if we have jobs. And according to Dr. Stinson, we are losing jobs at a greater rate than the national average. So that traditional thing of people going to school here, stay here, may not be in play during this recession unless we have jobs for them. So, okay. Any questions? More questions on reciprocity? Great. Thank you.
I can continue with more of the non-resident tuition, or if you want me to kind of move for the sake of time.
Yeah, no, if you have more to say on this, please do.
Okay. You asked about the impact of enrollment on the decision to eliminate the non-resident tuition. And at the seven colleges that were funded in 2007, enrollment of non-residents has increased. In one case, the enrollment has doubled, and in another case, it's about 50% increase.
But so what were the two colleges where it...
One was Minneapolis.
MCTC doubled?
Yes. And I'm having a moment on the 50%. We'll get back to you
okay.
on that. But we cannot say for sure that the single rate was the sole reason for the enrollment increase.
Senator Pappas, I'm sorry. I'm trying to follow along, and I'm just lost as to if there's some material that
we're
supposed to...
We're still on page one. It says oversight, review, and we're still on page one. We're talking about flat tuition or non-resident tuition.
And if you have the packet, our packet of testimony, it's about 40-something pages. Yeah, we're on page 32. Move into page 33.
Also, in your packet, there was a copy of the questions that we gave to MNSCU, and I don't know if mine are still here or not.
Madam Chair, those questions are repeated in the materials we gave back to you.
And
so the thicker packet.
Oversight review questions and responses?
Yes.
Okay.
On page 32 is where Karen is at the moment.
Oh, moving great. On to page 33.
Page 32. There. Oh, that's very helpful.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'd just like to ask, when Minneapolis Community College, were they the ones you said doubled their enrollment in non-residents? Did anyone keep track of whether the non-residents had Minnesota addresses or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I can't answer that question, but we can find out from our student system. We can research that.
I would like to see if there is some calculation of where those non-residents came from. It would be interesting.
We should be able to tell you.
Moving on to page 33, you had asked about how an extension of this requirement extension of the requirement or system-wide prohibition, how that would affect the system and or the individual campuses. Putting in place a system-wide prohibition for the four universities that still have a non-resident tuition rate would have a large financial impact. Would be about $4.5 million of lost revenue to the four universities. For the remaining six colleges who still retain a non-resident rate, the lost revenue is about $700,000. And it is worth noting that for some institutions, retaining a non-resident tuition rate does not negatively impact their competitiveness. And would not renewing this provision provide a meaningful source of revenue to campuses? If the provision were not renewed, possibly some of the colleges may consider returning to two rates, but we just haven't heard any of that at this point in time. So if there's any questions, more questions about non-resident, otherwise we can move on to the master green sheet.
It's not really green, though, in our paper,
no.
But it's called a green sheet. So two things you want to do is go to page 2 in the oversight review packet, and then with the questions, we're on page 33.
The green sheet is a document that we use to track the funds we receive from the state. And it distributes appropriation that comes out of the conference report at the end of the odd session year with any adjustments during the even session. Plus, it's the interest we earn on tuition and non-appropriated revenue that's in the state treasury. In the current fiscal year, we're tracking $688.3 million, and that's prior to the unallotment. The green sheet's divided into institutional base and priority allocations and system-wide set-asides. About 87% of the appropriation, which is $600.5 million, and you can see that kind of in the middle of the spreadsheet under the 2009 column, that $600 million flows out to our institutions either through the allocation framework or through other methods. And the next topic will be the allocation framework. What you heard at the hearing on the 12th of February and the non-resident tuition funding we just talked about first, those all appear in that middle grouping of items called priority allocations. It totals $48.7 million. So we've already testified about $34.8 million of that total. There still remains on the green sheet in that priority allocation area $2.5 million that's driven by student enrollment. That would be ALICE or sign language interpreter costs, farm business, small business management programs. So those dollars flow to where the students are. There's $9.4 million for a tuition buy down. In the current fiscal year, the Board of Trustees held tuition increases to 2% at our colleges and 3% increase at the universities. The $9.4 million is used for the tuition buy-down. It provides the state support to assure that our institutions had a 4% increase in their revenue stream. You recall that the tuition buy-down was promoted and funded by this committee 2 years ago. There's also $1.2 million that is tied to contract non-credit network funding. This supports some regional collaboration and some other specific projects. The next group of expenses toward the bottom of the green sheet is what we call set-asides. These are funds taken off the top and they're paid centrally, such as our attorney general services, debt service on our GO bonds, and the system-wide audit program. At the end of the year, these expenses, along with the revenue, are transferred back to our institutions through an assessment process that uses varying factors. This allows for consistent reporting of financial data nationally. The other item in the set-aside is the cost of operating the Office of the Chancellor, the Shared Services Division, and the system-wide enterprise technology.
So when people talk about the central office, are they talking about the $48.4 million, or is the central office just the $20.3 million, the Office of the Chancellor?
Madam Chair, this what we would consider the central office, which is Office of the Chancellor, Shared Service, and the Enterprise Technology, is the in fiscal 9, the $48.4
million.
$48 million,
so that's the central office. Okay.
And the $21 million up above in the Enterprise Technology, up in the system-wide set-aside. And we're going to restructure this green sheet a little bit coming
okay,
into
so you,
next
you
biennium.
Okay, so you combine $39 million with $48
million. No.
You combine 21 million of the 39, so it's the 48 okay. plus 21. So it's about 70 million there, mm-hmm. which includes also the presidential compensations that we have within the Office of the Chancellor.
So the all the presidents, their salaries are included in this item.
Correct.
Budget item.
Overall, the state appropriation benefits the operations of each of our institutions, whether it's through the direct appropriations, through set-asides, or through the services provided by the Office of the Chancellor. Are there any further questions on what we call the master green sheet?
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I hope I haven't missed this. I know I've been out quite a bit, but does anything in any of these line items reflect or should reflect federal stimulus dollars? For example, in the area of teachers of diverse background, it seems to me that within the stimulus package, one of the components for higher ed had to do with dollars pertaining to teacher quality programs and to improve teacher preparation.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, there's nothing before you today that has any of the federal stimulus dollars reflected. We would look forward to a conversation with the committee about that money, but we're all sort of pending some recommendations so that we have something to respond to. This is just the straight, this is just the state appropriated dollars, just the historical dollars that move through your omnibus spending bill every year. When we look at the federal stimulus program, we think there's $40 to $50 million that will be available to serve the folks we serve, either through workforce training programs, displaced workers, summer bridge programs, summer youth work programs, and another. We think there's another several hundred million dollars that will be available to us as part of the general stimulus formula. There's also expected to be some funds flowing through K-12, which I think is where the Teachers of Diverse Programs, Diverse Background Program is housed in the federal bill.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, you might want to get some time on your calendar. Give us a couple of weeks, and we'd love to spend some time talking with you about this. We're just a little bit not clear on the facts yet, but we think there's a lot of good conversation there.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that would be time well spent, and I think it's particularly important because just from a real practical standpoint, anything that we can do to utilize those federal stimulus dollars in ways that make sense might give us more flexibility, and I think that could be good for our students.
Senator Roebling.
I think one of the problems we're going to have is that the federal legislation gave it to education in general, and it doesn't distinguish between higher ed and K-12 as much in some areas. And I don't know who's going to get the piece of the pie first, but K-12 usually does. So,
Madam Chair, Senator
Roebling,
the federal law has some proration language in it. So this section of the bill is a K-12 and higher ed section. And there's some formulas that are involved and calculations for how the money's distributed. And then there's proration if there's not enough to hit the formulas. So I would expect there to be some money for higher ed.
But the reality is, with our $6.4 billion shortfall, that money is most likely to be used to mitigate cuts, so that we are cutting less than we'd have to otherwise over the next 2 years. And there is a memo that was passed out from Mr. Mossman that talks about the legislative role in reviewing the ARRA funds. So if you want to take a look at that, and if you have any questions, feel free to talk to Mr. Albrecht or Mr. Mossman about it. Okay, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm now on page 34 of the full testimony, and the handouts are pages 3 through 5 in the small overview packet. I'm moving on to the allocation model. Just to give you a brief description of the allocation framework that we have in place to distribute resources to our colleges and universities. The current framework distributes base appropriation among our colleges and universities, and it was developed over a number of years with the involvement of more than 100 staff from throughout our system, serving on 13 work groups. During the development process, the framework was discussed widely with all of our system constituent groups, and input was sought from them as well as national experts. The concept for the framework was adopted by the Board of Trustees in 2000, and the specific components were developed between 2000 and 2004. The framework was fully implemented in fiscal 2006. Due to the diversity of the system, the framework uses a number of factors to recognize the differences. The framework only distributes state appropriation, and it can only distribute the resources we have available. Even though the framework might generate a need for additional funding, we can't print money, so the framework distributes just what we have available.
Ms. King, who was the chancellor when the framework was developed?
Madam Chair, the first framework was developed under Chancellor Eaton. That was tabled, and she was the first chancellor for the system. That was tabled. The next chancellor then was Maury Anderson,
mm-hmm.
And he was in place for most of the development, but the adoption and implementation has been under Chancellor McCormick.
Okay.
In fiscal year 2009, approximately $540 million is distributed through the allocation framework to our institutions. There's five components within the framework, and the pages 3 through 5, the handout, gives you more detail of each of the components, gives you a brief description of the component and the data that we use to run each of those components. But the five components are instruction and academic support, administrative, facilities, library, and then we have a research and public service. There are numerous formulas within each of these components. Enrollment is the biggest factor in the model. It really affects all of the five areas. Factors we use in the framework include national spending by similar public 2 and 4 year institutions. We use actual academic program expenses and enrollment, square footage, and actual utility expenses, just to name a few. Each factor impacts the amount of appropriation the colleges and universities receive. The framework was developed with the understanding that it remains open to continuous improvement. During the past year, the presidents discussed their concerns they had about the allocation process. Those discussions did not result in any major changes to the framework, but it really brought up the need for system-level discussions on some major policy issues that are driven by the pressures for the tight resources that our system is experiencing. So the pages 3 through 5 will give you some additional information. This was kind of a quick overview of it. Any questions?
Madam Chair, we might also mention that Karen and staff have sat down with your staff on more than one occasion for several hours to go through the framework. And we're always available to do that, to respond to any questions members have. We also have a group of campus CFOs and CAOs. It's a standing technical advisory group that addresses questions that come up in the course of events, and that leads to some technical adjustments from time to time.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Sharon.
I wonder, after those discussions that you have now that this has been implemented, once you implement something, something has become apparent that may have been unintended consequences. Were in those discussions, what are some of the themes or issues that are being raised about this allocation framework?
Ms. King.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I think the one that comes most quickly to mind is that at one level, this is a mechanical thing. I mean, it has parts, and the parts have rules for how they move, and when you put the money in, the parts move the money. And so it works at any dollar level put into it. And we talked very carefully at the time of the design about making sure that it would work whether money was going up or down. But we did not contemplate money going down like it has and like we're facing. And that has really opened up a series of conversations with the presidents that are not about the allocation framework, but just about resources and how are we going to do business going forward. I think that's the most powerful impact that we've seen. Karen mentioned we had a series of surveys and focus groups and conversations with the presidents over the past year, and it started out being about the allocation process, but they quickly recognized that it wasn't about the allocation model. It was about the pressures they're facing, whether it's enrollment pressures or cost pressures or population dispersion pressures. And so we've took those questions away from the allocation framework, and we've started a new set of conversations with the presidents. That's led to conversations about regionalizing services, about using technology now that we've had the technology investment we've had, it's made it possible for us to use technology in a different way. It's led to some conversations about curriculum coordination between the campuses. So more on the business side and not on the formula side. So it's been very good. In terms of sort of fundamental design issues from the framework itself, we really haven't tripped over any. There's a continuing debate that sort of rises and falls about how we treat certain things, but they're really on the margin from an impact standpoint.
Moving on, now I'm on page 35 of the full testimony. You had asked how much revenue a 1% increase in tuition generates, and it's $6.5 million. It's $3.5 million for the colleges and $3 million for the universities. I'll now move on to reserves. There is in your packet a handout that shows the reserve balances for each of our colleges and universities.
Page 6.
And it's on page 6. Board policy sets the requirements for designated cash reserve levels. And the policy requires that colleges and universities maintain a general fund cash reserve in the range of 5 to 7% of their total general fund revenue. In addition, the policy allows the system to maintain a reserve at 2% of total system appropriation. So on the spreadsheet on page 6, the colleges and universities ended 2008 with about $70.7 million in reserves, and the system had a reserve at about $7 million, which is just about 1% of total appropriation. Reserves may be called upon in cases where other reasonable methods have been insufficient to maintain a balanced budget. You know, generally there's three primary uses for reserves: to protect the system and individual institutions in cases of sudden shortfalls in revenue. It could be an unforeseen loss in enrollment. It could be a reduction in state appropriation during a particular biennium. Also, they can be used to cover unanticipated expenses, such as one-time legal fees, major disasters, or there could be an unanticipated increase in utility costs. And then reserves could be used to provide for extraordinary one-time investments. Any college or university that has a reserve below 5% must provide Vice Chancellor, Chief Financial Officer, with information on current fiscal conditions and a detailed plan on how they're going to achieve the minimum level. Any college or university that's above the 7% also needs a plan in place with the chief financial officer. As we approached the unallotment in 2009, the board cautioned our institutions from using reserves for the unallotment. We believe that the reserves are going to be much more critical to transition through the next biennium. Any questions on the reserves?
So are there any colleges that are below 5% or above 7%?
Look, Madam Chair, looking on page 6, the spreadsheet, there are a couple of the institutions that are above 7%, maybe three or four of them, mostly at the two-year colleges. There's
what
also
column would you should we look at?
It's the fourth column. Okay. You see the 2008 actual reserve, and then the next column is the mm-hmm. percentage that goes with that. So that gives you that this shows the varying levels of reserves at each of our institutions. There is Rochester College is below the minimum level, but they have a plan on file with Vice Chancellor King as to the reason for their spending of that and how they'll restore the reserve.
Madam Chair, if I might, that's a perfect example. Rochester ran into a surprise in a construction project and had to do very expensive asbestos abatement. And it hadn't been included in the capital project request, and so we worked with them to figure out a way to keep the capital project moving by using reserves and then, as part of their budget process, budgeting to restore reserves over the next several years. So that's a classic call on reserves.
And are some of the campuses that are over the 7%, are they saving up for a piece of equipment or something?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then what about, why is Fond du Lac at zero?
Madam Chair, Fond du Lac has been in a very precarious financial position for several years. It was precipitated by the loss of the BIA support, and I believe we've talked with you about that. They were, through their partnership with the tribe for many, many years, since 84 maybe, they had built up an infrastructure of program and services that had been supported by a grant from the federal government. And they lost that grant several years ago very precipitously. And so they have been working very hard over the last couple of years to get themselves back in balance.
Do you have a new president there?
We have an interim president, Larry Anderson, mm-hmm. who's just doing a fantastic job.
Chair? Questions? Yes, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is very good information for me, being a new member on the committee. I am a little concerned about when you talk about using some of the reserves to balance budgets. I think we put ourselves in the same position as looking at some of the federal stimulus money as a way to soften our cuts. Is there a conversation about if you use reserves for hitting a budget target, what's going to happen the next couple of years? Even if the economy rebounds, I don't know that we're going to have lots of extra money, you're still going to have a structural balance problem.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson-Ropes, we agree with you completely. And this is exactly the same conversation we've had with our Board of Trustees. We recognize that reserves are a very precious resource, and we've had extended conversations with our presidents, and we'll expect them to have plans that show us how it's a one-time use. And furthermore, show us as part of their out-year plans, how they expect to restore them, mm-hmm. because we agree with you completely. It would be the height of mismanagement for us to spend all these reserves and then get to the end of the federal stimulus dollars and be in an even more precarious financial condition. And our board's very worried about that.
Thank you.
I'm now going to turn to Vice Chancellor Laura King to address the financial statements. And we're moving on to page 36 of the testimony. And we're on pages 7 and 8 of the handout.
Okay, Karen. Vice Chancellor.
Karen has just spent some time here today with you, and I know in her earlier time with you, talking about things on the budget side of the House. We run a budgetary, a cash planning process, and then at the end of the year we prepare full accrual financial statements and have those statements audited. And so I'm going to switch gears now and talk about our financial position from a full accrual standpoint. On page 7 and 8, you have extracts from our financial statements, and we were directed to these two pages by the staff from the committee. I brought with me just to show you, this is a copy of our most recent set of audited financial statements, and then we have what we call the supplement, which is balance sheets and income statements and footnotes. Got my hands mixed up. That shows each of the colleges. So if you're interested in seeing at the college level, we can certainly make that. And it's online. So
I was going to say,
it's all online. It's all on our webpage, so you could access it that way as well. It has been our practice now for 8 years, I believe, and you saw it on the green sheet. There's a line that says system audit program. We spend about $1 million a year hiring auditors who audit the system financial statements, and then we hire different auditors who audit 12 of the colleges and universities on a standalone basis. That's particularly important for the universities because in their fundraising activity, in their grant application activity, it's an important sort of good housekeeping seal of approval to be able to provide audited financial statements. It's a measure of financial soundness. So all the state universities have separately prepared and audited financial statements, and then five of our largest colleges do as well. And they're all consolidated and compiled into the two documents that I held up. All of that information is what you have here at the enterprise level. You could see this same kind of information in 32 columns for each of the colleges and universities if you wanted to, and it's available to you. So that's the accrual side. We also have prepared and audited financial statements for the revenue fund, which we talked about a little bit earlier today, and that's a necessary condition for us because we go into the capital markets and sell bonds for the revenue fund. And so it's expected that there are audited financial statements available in a situation like that. Turning to page 7, in the smaller of the two handouts, this is the consolidated statement of revenues and expenses for the entire system. It shows both fiscal 8 and fiscal 7. And you'll see operating revenues, which include tuition, restricted student payments, federal grants, state grants, and other income. In 2008, a total of $983 million. Mm-hmm. And then look down, skip over the next block of lines for just a second, and look down to the block labeled non-operating revenues. That's where you see the state appropriation, along with other private grants, some interest income, and some other entries. So really, you have to add those two numbers together to get to our total revenue. It's presented this way by standards of the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, and it makes us all crazy because we can't see revenue in one place, but they have a view about how to treat state appropriation, and that's what drives it to be presented this way. So total revenue of about $1.7 billion if you add those two numbers together, and that compares then coming back up to the middle block of numbers. Total operating expenses is about $1.6 billion. And in here you see all the general fund activity, all the revenue fund activity, all the auxiliary activity, all the student financial aid. If the student grants and loans flow through our schools, that's captured here. And that brings us to a total expense of $1.7 billion. Down below then in the bottom block of numbers, you see a number of $102 million. That is the value of the capital appropriation that you provide us through the general obligation bond program. A portion of the general obligation bonds come onto our books as essentially a gift because we don't pay debt service on it. And that's what that $102 million represents. So bottom line for us in fiscal 8, we had $119 million improvement in our net assets. and you see that third number from the bottom, virtually all of that was the capital appropriation and isn't available to us to pay salaries or to buy new computers or to replace furniture. Right above that $102 million, you see $8.4 million. That represents what you could characterize as our profit. In very broad terms, that's what we had left of our revenues after we reflected all of our obligations. So it's a very closely managed financial.
Does that just stay for cash flow, or does that go into a reserve fund?
Madam Chair, that is in, it's in 15 accounts mm-hmm. across several funds. It might be cash. It might not be cash. Mm-hmm. It is available at the fund level. Whether it goes into reserves or it goes into some other use next year, I'd have to track it for you to show you. The $7 million you see in 07, most if not all of that $7 million, I think, occurred in the part of our activities that are supported by student fees. So I would view that as student fee money that the students will make a decision about how to spend next year. The general fund, if you looked at these numbers just for the general fund, that number was negative in fiscal 8. I don't have it in front of me how negative it was, but it was several million dollars negative. But this brings all the funds up together, so you lose that distinction. Also in the package is, on the next page, on page 8, is the operating expenses by functional classification that I understand we also had a question about. And this tracks on page 37 of the notes. Recall I mentioned the $1.6 billion in expenses in fiscal 8. You can see that $1.6 billion if you look in the total column down at the bottom, it's footnote number 11, and then look at the next group of numbers titled for the year ended June 30th, 2008, and then you see their total operating expenses, $1.6 billion. We take our expenses, before you saw them along salary, purchase services, operating expenses. Here you see them by how we spend the money programmatically. So this shows you of the $1.6 billion, $657 million was spent directly on instruction. $202 million was spent on academic support, $200 million on student services, $142 million on maintenance and plant, and $114 on auxiliary enterprises, and then some other things less material. We don't see much movement in these classifications from year to year. There's language in statute that sets as a goal for us that we spend more than 60% a year on instruction and academic support. Well, on
I think we increase.
That we increase
each
our
year.
Right. On
instruction and academic support.
And we track this, and those two together have floated between 62 and 65% of our expenditures as long as I've been tracking it. These numbers are very stable.
Ms. King, do the definitions of each of these areas, are there like national definitions for what falls in that area for purposes of comparison?
Madam Chair, there absolutely are. There's a standard-setting body nationally that controls these classifications so that when this information is provided to national databases, and then you hear us say to you later that we're the 46th highest spender on administrative activity in the country, mm-hmm. that comes out of this data collected nationally.
And that category is institutional support, or
right.
what category
right.
is that?
Exactly.
Okay.
You have that information here for both fiscal 7 and fiscal 8, and I think, Karen, that takes care of the questions here. Right. It depends on where you're standing. That's correct. Madam Chair, if there are no questions about this segment of the information, I'll turn you back to page 38.
Okay.
Okay.
And Karen, in the narrative, you'll find much more information and more explanation on a couple of websites, or just be in touch and we'll provide you any information you'd like.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Just so that I bring this to a level that I am sure that what you're talking about is relating to some of the questions that when we're engaged in these statewide discussions about how to deal with this budget deficit, and we talk about the higher education budget, and then furthermore about MNSCU's budget, mm-hmm. as you know, there's always within a finite amount of money struggles for where these dollars are allocated. And when I'm looking at this, I want to know if what I'm looking at here, what would you direct me to look at that would help me talk with people about their concerns that the percent of the expenditures, the revenues that are spent, are out of proportion for central services and central offices as opposed to those dollars that go directly
right.
to the classroom.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, there's a couple of ways to approach thinking about that. We have looked at what the whole organization spends on administration. And that takes what we spend in St. Paul plus what all the 32 colleges spend, and that picks up the business office, the president's office, the
human resources,
technology, sort of the normal back office administrative operations. When we add up what all the colleges and universities and the central office spend, there are only four states in the country that spend less than we do. So that's one sort of data point for us. The next data point is when we look at how much of the state appropriation we spend in the central office compared to how much we sent out. And Karen has for you in the smaller packet the so-called green sheet. And when you look at the green sheet, and Senator Pappas asked about this, we have $48 million for the chancellor's office and for shared services, and another $21 million for technology, the central technology function. So
that was page 2.
Page 2 of the skinny
of the oversight review.
So that's call that $70 million out of $682 million. So that tells us something slightly more than 10% of the state appropriation only is used to pay the expenses of the central administration. So that's another way to look at it. Another way we look at it is how much does the central function spend as a percentage of total revenue? When you think about, you know, the Charities Review Council, for instance, expects they have some guidelines for administration, and those guidelines are upwards of 10% is an acceptable, quote, spending level for administration. So when you look at what the central function spends as a percentage of total revenue, you get a number like 1%. So that's the third data point for us. Another, and stop me if this is too much. But
I just want to make sure I understood. The last night you said 10% was the accepted number, and you're talking about 1% of the total revenues.
That's correct.
But it's an industry standard at the 10%.
Well, there really isn't one for the business we're in, so we've looked around and tried to find one. So it's 1% of total revenue. It's about 10% if you look at those three lines on the green sheet of just state appropriation. But recall that state appropriation is $682 million, and the system's total revenue is about $1.6 billion. So our accounting system is processing $1.6 billion worth of revenue, of which $680 comes from your support. So that's another way to think about it. We're very interested in learning whether we could make some changes in how we've, over the last 10 years, organized the work that gets done on the campuses versus the work that gets done in St. Paul. And the chancellor today or tomorrow, I think, is going to be talking with the chair of the Legislative Audit Commission to suggest to them that they look at this as a program review topic for next year.
It's been a question in people's minds really since the merger. We'd be very interested if there's things we could do better. We hear from one segment of the community that tells us that we should take onto a central platform more of the work than we already have. And we hear from another segment of the community that says we should devolve all of the central work to the campuses. And so the the balance is a constant sort of negotiation. We think that through the work that the central service function performs, we save the system hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars a year in administrative costs and in technology platform costs. But we'd like someone else to look at it for us.
Madam Chair, Sharon. I appreciate hearing that because I think that is an absolutely fabulous idea because I do hear as well what you're hearing, that the Minsky system as a system and its centralization should be eliminated. We should go back to individual campuses. So that audit gets structured to answer those kinds of questions that include, I suppose that's out of the range of what we need to accomplish here today, but I really support that with questions that say, what is the implications of not having the system in place? And bringing that forward in some kind of an objective analysis through an audit would be fabulous.
Okay, so we've passed out an organizational chart. And so I want to say this is the central office or this is all institutional support.
Madam Chair, this is the whole enterprise. It starts with the Board of Trustees. Mm-hmm. Then you see the Chancellor. Over on the left, you see all the university and college presidents. Mm-hmm. You see the employees that report up to those presidents. We have about 19,000 employees mm-hmm. that report up to the presidents. And then the rest of this chart deals with the employees that report directly to the chancellor through either the shared services function or the office or the chancellor's policy function. The boxes that are in the right and in the lower half of this chart represent about 380 to 400 employees. So the Office of the Chancellor in the Shared Services Division has about 400 employees in it, and then all the campuses have about 19,000 employees. I would add just as a note, of those 400 employees, I think something up to 100 are located out on campuses. We have technology and internal audit staff in 8 or 9 locations around the state: Bemidji, Mankato, Perham, St. Cloud, Moorhead. I don't have it. Eveleth.
So I can't say though that this chart represents institutional support because you also have faculty on this chart.
Madam Chair, this chart wasn't designed to tie back to the table you saw earlier. No,
all right.
But it does. If you were to take this chart
apart,
this represents all of the spending that's caught in that table.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just institutional support spending.
Okay. But you did mention that the lines to the right and the lines going down, that's what you consider central office, shared services, and Office of the Chancellor.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. If you look, the technology group, for instance, here, the in the lower right-hand set of boxes, 149 employees. Those are all in the shared services group.
Mm-hmm.
Labor relations, of a significant portion of those personnel, perform work for the campuses in a team function. In the finance group, I have staff in that group that have built a consolidated loan collection group. So we have 2.5 or 3 people that manage the collection of loans for 12 or 15 colleges and universities. They don't staff it anymore. We staff it in one group and share the software to do it. And then academic and student affairs, in that group you'll see things like the Center for Teaching and Learning, the Minnesota Online support for the campuses, the iSeek support for the campuses. We have staff in the Academic and Student Affairs group that are paid for by a collective of multiple campuses, but they're housed here and they work under standard protocols and research methodologies so that the work product is
systematized, I guess.
People that are part of your shared services and central office, where are they officed?
Madam Chair, they're officed about 100 of them are out of the Twin Cities, mm-hmm. And the remainder are either in St. Paul or in Minneapolis. We have a large contingent on the Minneapolis Community and Technical College campus in some lower-level space that we built out in the Billy Graham building that you helped us buy five or 6 years ago. They're in what we call the garden level, but what some of them call the basement.
And then the chancellor's staff, is it the chancellor's staff that's in the former World Trade Center building?
The chancellor's staff is in the World Trade building, along with some of the technology staff. My staff are there, the academic and student affairs and HR staff are there.
Okay.
Okay, is that helpful?
Very helpful.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'll move on to the last item we have, tuition and fees, at least the last item for Laura and myself. And I'm just going to give you just a brief highlight of the comprehensive tuition and fee study that was undertaken last year at the direction of our Board of Trustees. And I'm on page 38 of the full testimony. The study included a look at the current tuition and fee policy. It's how did we get to where we are? It looked at gross and net tuition and fee and compared that to regional and national peer colleges and or similar colleges and universities. Looked at the dependency on tuition revenue, the role of financial aid in the cost of attendance, and total spending per student, and compared that to the regional and nationwide averages. Regarding appropriation and tuition reliance, our system's reliance on appropriation decreased over the past decade from about 70% to the current 50.5%. Likewise, tuition over the past decade, our reliance has increased from 30% to just about 50%. The reliance on appropriation varies greatly by college and university, from 42% to 67% reliance on appropriation. Institutions that are more heavily reliant on appropriation are the technical and comprehensive colleges located in Greater Minnesota. The appropriation per student at our system's colleges was below both the regional and nationwide averages for similar two-year institutions. The appropriation per student at our universities was comparable to the regional average and below our nationwide average. When we looked at tuition and fees, and we just looked at the resident, undergraduate, gross, and net of financial aid, at our colleges, the average tuition and fees are higher than both regional and nationwide. That was no surprise to us. I think you're familiar with the ranking that we do when we look nationally, and our colleges are second now nationwide when we look at the undergraduate tuition and fee. And it's for similar public two-year institutions. Our universities, the net tuition was higher than the regional and the nationwide averages. Our universities rank 18th among similar four-year institutions. The study looked at the net cost to students after financial aid. The comparison year in the tuition study was 2007. And during that year, the students enrolled in our colleges and universities received about $733 million of financial aid. The majority of the financial aid was in the form of grants and loans. And what we found is for students that were enrolled at least half-time, the lowest income half-time student within the system paid a higher share of their costs. They paid about 67% of their costs. And when we talk about the cost to a student, it's really the cost of attendance includes tuition, fees, room and board, books, supplies, transportation, and some miscellaneous expense. The study also did an analysis of the cost of a student's educational experience. What we mean by that is, what are our colleges and universities spending to educate students? We know that costs differ by institutions. Some of the cost drivers are personnel, the faculty mix, how many courses, how many students you have, what's your academic program mix, what kind of support services are offered to students, and then age and expansion of facilities. Generally, the spending per student
Hold on just a second. Senator Sharon.
May I ask you a question? What popped in my mind as you were talking about the mix, at making having an impact on the cost differential between institutions, it caused me to wonder, and I want to ask so I'm not misled. If you have an institution of higher education, the MNSCU system, that has a higher number of programs that are associated with requirements that have low student faculty ratios or have more expensive laboratory training programs like hygienists or engineering, if you have a higher mix of those programs, is that system, that university, underwriting some of the costs of those programs by distributing across the overall tuition, which makes it different than another university? Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that's part of what I'm saying. It's looking at a program mix. With your example, an institution that would be maybe more heavily focused on health, you have the smaller class ratios, there'd be a tendency for the institution to be spending more per student than an institution, for instance, a community college that is more liberal arts focused, higher, more lecture, higher faculty student ratios. So it really depends on the focus, the type of program with more of the sciences. You get into a university, you have upper division and graduate level. So there's a lot of different factors that would impact.
Senator Sharon.
And just very briefly, going back to my earlier question about the discussion between the presidents about the distribution formula, whatever that was called, is in that formula, in that technical formula, are these issues addressed somehow in a factor of some sort? Or does it become an issue of conflict between in the systems?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, in our allocation framework, we do separate out level of instruction. So we are looking at lower division, separate from upper, separate from graduate. We also, in the instructional component, we are comparing similar programs, which is defined by the classification code system for instructional programs. So we're comparing English to English. We're comparing nursing to nursing. So it's really back to in the beginning when I talked about kind of the diversity of our system. The way our framework was built is to really recognize the diversity by looking at programs very specifically and not just saying all lower division is X amount, and then separating it out by level. And I think that's one of the strengths in our allocation framework.
Okay.
Generally, spending per student at a technical college would be higher in instruction because it's due to high cost. You've got equipment-intensive technical programs with the lower faculty-student ratios. When you think about spending per student at a community college, it is generally lower in instruction due to the lower cost, the predominant lecture delivered liberal arts with the higher faculty student ratios. Spending per student in physical plant generally is higher at a technical college. Once again, it's due to that instructional space needed to deliver those technical programs compared to a liberal arts and science that is more lecture-driven auditorium, larger classrooms. As we looked at our spending per student at the system colleges, the spending was higher than both the regional and nationwide averages. We were about $800 more than the regional and about $1,400 per student more than nationwide. The spending per student at our universities was less at both the regional and nationwide averages. So they were universities are spending about $1,600 to $1,700 per student less than similar four-year institutions.
Okay, we're going to have you stop there. Thank you very much.
Because
I think we have discussed, did we discuss the accountability framework at our last meeting? Mm-hmm. Previous years. Okay, we're kind of running out of time. So we're going to revert back to the letter and the bills that we have now.
We need a
we have 781 and we have 990, so we can see what the bills say. And, you know, Senator Langseth.
Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Langseth will, it was very helpful. Thank you. Senator Langseth will kind of take that into consideration when he, as he's going to, I think, roll out his proposal next week. So we wanted to get this to him before he does that. So are there any questions or comments about the two bills, the letter? Senator Roebling, have you had a chance to look at it?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have. And, you know, as I expressed before, I'm not thinking that the Bell Museum should be a top priority in this session. I have no problems with some of the HEPR projects, and I especially appreciate how they're spread around the state, how they're kind of targeted for energy savings. I think some of those things are really good. And, you know, if we get more money, to me, I would rather see the university spend more money on HEPR than a brand new project.
Mm-hmm. And certainly you can, I'm sure you will make those comments known in the Capital Investment Committee as well that you serve on. Okay. Does someone want to make a motion to approve the letter? Senator Tomasoni moves that the aforementioned letter be forwarded to Senator Langseth. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, no more business to come before the committee. The committee's adjourned.